Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the January edition of On Tap. Thank you so much for being here this evening. I'm Kelly Burley with KOSU, and we're so glad that you could be here for our first On Tap of the new year. Happy belated new year to everyone tonight. How many people are in short sleeves tonight? It's great for January, don't you think? I hear we broke a 122-year record for high temperature today.
Okay.
It reached, I think, 79 or 80. So it's a great way to start the new year. An even better way to start the new year is to hear from our two panelists tonight as we prepare for another legislative session, which is just around the corner. Before we do that, a couple of housekeeping items for you tonight. The specials here at Picasso are the vegan red curry with leeks, and the beer special is Stella tonight. I would like to introduce my team at KOSU. Rachel Hubbard, Associate Director, General Manager. Where's Rachel? Ken Boyd is our IT and engineer. He's the guy that makes this sound good in here tonight. Who else do we have?
Michael, work.
And of course, our moderator this evening is Morning Edition host Michael Cross.
Okay.
He's been up for 24 hours, folks. So. You know, when you get up at 3 in the morning to do Morning Edition, which he does every weekday, you never know what could happen after dark. So, but anyway, again, we're thrilled that you're here this evening, and I'm looking forward to a great conversation. I hope you find it informative and entertaining as well. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Michael. Thank you all for being here tonight.
Now, keep it up for Kelly Burley. He makes this whole thing possible. Thank you very much. Good evening, Oklahoma, and we are so glad that you are here. Just in case you didn't know, this Monday, the legislature is going back in session. So watch your wallets. This happens, of course, every year. On the 1st February, the state legislature meets. They're constitutionally told to meet on the 1st February, first Monday of February to the last Friday of May. So the next 4 months, they'll be there talking about bills. They'll be talking about the budget. There's a lot of things going to be going on. And fortunately, we've got a fantastic panel who helps decide and answer your questions not only tonight, but every week. Please give a hand to Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. And also, in case you didn't know, they join me every Friday morning during Morning Edition for This Week in Oklahoma Politics. This week's going to be no different. We'll have some. We'll probably talk a little bit about some of the subjects we're going to have to talk about tonight. We're going to start out with a couple of statements, just a couple of minutes, just for each of you, and then I'm going to open it up to questions. So start thinking about questions that you want to ask either of our panelists. Neva, let's go ahead and start with you.
Okay. Well,
so much for us getting a couple of shots.
There you go. Well, very briefly, I mean, I think it's a repeat session coming up in many ways because everyone has clearly identified all of the problems, and once again, no one is really coming up with real serious solutions, at least on the front end. And I think that will be the challenge, certainly for the Republican majority to step up to the plate, and this time after the significant election wins in 2014, begin to produce some results on some of these big questions. The governor's laid out, at least preliminarily, you know, the overarching themes of what the big ticket items and the big problems are, but we've yet to see any real specifics, and I think that's probably what we'll talk about a little bit more tonight.
Ryan.
I think the big story this session, as it is every set, well, first let me say big thanks to KOSU for having us here. Big thanks for Picasso's for hosting us. You know, we call this ACLU West because it's just right across the street from our offices, so we're over here quite a bit. And while I'm talking about the ACLU, none of the comments that I make tonight are necessarily attributable to the ACLU of Oklahoma. I'm here of my own volition. That's the boilerplate language. But it's the budget, and we're starting off. I only play one on TV. the budget this year, we're starting off with less revenue than we have than we had last legislative session. And if you look all the way back to 2009, The budget is $680 million, or 8.6% below the fiscal year 2009. So we saw these huge cuts during the economic downturn. We've never really recovered from that. And in the meantime, we've just been kind of cobbling together these state budgets. Last year, we used a lot of one-time revenues from rollover funds and cash reserve accounts. We saw the governor recently say that she wanted to do that again this year. And that's like putting the budget together with Play-Doh. When we've got these long-term sustainability issues with regard to funding state services, and we're using one-time cash rollovers to fund everything, that's, to me, a huge red flag that the Fallon administration, going into her second term, isn't really embracing this opportunity to become a real leader. Because she does. I mean, I've been a huge critic of Governor Fallon, and probably will be this evening and throughout the legislative session. There are things that she's done that I've been very grateful for. But at the end of the day, what we've seen is a lot of politics from her office. And what Oklahoma desperately needs right now is some political leadership. If she will step back from campaign mode, I think that Governor Fallon could really use this second term in office to become a Henry Bellman type figure. We haven't seen that real evidence of that happening so far, but if she does, you know, we could see some real long-term gains for our state.
Let me open it up to questions. Who's got a question? Well, let's start out with the budget. Ryan, here we go.
We have some examples from nearby Kansas where the governor has persisted with tax cuts. Their bond rating is much lower. Why do we have, in Oklahoma, with such a great example of what doesn't work, do we persist in the face of reduced oil revenue coming in, oil tax revenue coming in, do we persist with the need for tax cuts?
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, you have to take into account that the taxpayer wants to have more dollars in their pocket than they want going to the government to be spent. They want services provided. There is an, in my view, ample money there. What we've got to do is we've got to look at some of these areas that have been kind of off limits, and now some are saying maybe we need to put on the table, such as tax credits, such as incentives, such as some of these things where there are, you know, literally hundreds of millions of dollars that could be at play. Not all of it needs to be wiped away, but there are places where clearly over time there has been enough change that they may not be needed at the levels that they are today. So I think rather than get mired into a lot of legislation that has very little to do with dealing with the budget, what lawmakers have got to do is get serious about getting up front and start to really look at agencies, really look at spending, really look at where the dollars are going, because the dollars can be realigned and reallocated. I mean, whether you use whatever phrase you want to utilize, right-sizing government, limiting government, retooling government, anything, it still is a possibility. And I would submit that a majority of Oklahomans have proven over and over again at the ballot box that this is the kind of government that they want to see, more limited and more directed at the services that are really needed.
Ryan?
So, and anytime that I'm talking about budget issues, another disclaimer, there's your lawyer disclaimer, I'm probably looking at the Oklahoma Policy Institute's website and their information. So a huge shout out to those folks, David Blatt, Gene Perry, and that entire crew at OK Policy. There you go. David, thank you. I'm going to take with attribution, give money to OK Policy if you're not already. But the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority needs $100 million more to replace one-time carryover funding. Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services needs an additional $10.2 million. Department of Corrections needs an additional $26.2 million. The Department of Human Services needs $15.9 million. I think, and you know, I've had this conversation with folks about the lack of revenue coming into the state of Oklahoma, and in the face of that lack of revenue, we continue to pass these tax cuts that we just can't afford to have. And we say, well, why do we do that? And I think that until there's some political disincentive for politicians to not continue to vote for tax cuts, and then the next year show up and throw their hands up and act surprised that they've got a budget that's in shambles, until there's some disincentive. I mean, the case, as the Oklahoma Policy Institute in a blog said, the case has been made that tax cuts do not stimulate the economy the way that the proponents have said. And you pointed out Kansas. Kansas is the perfect example for that. And What we haven't seen are politicians losing elections because they vote for tax cuts, politicians losing elections because they cave to the oil and gas industry and give them $250 million tax cut to drill horizontal wells that they were going to drill anyways. So I think that until we see that time, we shouldn't expect the legislature to give up its addiction to tax cuts.
By the same token, in elections, when you have an opportunity to vote for someone who has voted for substantial tax increases or someone who has voted for a minimal tax cut, I would submit that more times than not, you're going to see the person who has been standing in the gap and saying that we're not just going to spend, because, you know, we talk about all of these dollars and where we have need for more dollars. We also have to factor into the equation the fact that at the federal level, when we continue to take federal dollars, even if it's on a short term, 2 years or whatever the time frame is, and then we turn around and have a $50 million gap in 24 months because we took that money that looked so good, solved a problem we thought pretty quickly until everybody got in the weeds and really read the details and figured out all we were doing is digging a deeper and deeper hole. So I think it's easy to want to look at the quick fix and say, you know, that we can just, you know, allocate more money and that's going to solve the problems. We have a history in this country as well as in Oklahoma. If we didn't have a balanced budget provision, we'd be in the same mess we are in Washington.
Yeah, I just wonder what effect would the falling prices in oil, what effect is that going to have on the budget?
Well, I think clearly, I mean, what the conversation already is people are going to have to take a very cautious look. I don't think it is a situation yet where, based on a lot of the forecasts that are out there, that in Oklahoma we may not see as dramatic a slide as some of these other states like Louisiana and others are looking at that are much more tied totally in their budget to oil and gas revenue. So I think in Oklahoma, I think we've got to be very, very deliberate in terms of where we make where we make budget decisions, because there are going to be some adjustments without a doubt. I just don't think at this moment they hopefully will be as extreme. Looking at the forecasts in the third and fourth quarter, that they may be actually on the uptick.
Ryan.
Well, you know, the budget certification, the preliminary certification assumed budget oil. Price per barrel around $60. You know, it's well below that right now. Some folks are saying that it could, you know, I was reading today, some folks said it could go as low as $30 a barrel. I think that that's probably on the extreme end. But when the state certifies the new revenues that the legislature will actually be working with, we're going to be looking at revenues that are well below that $60 preliminary estimate. So, I mean, I think that we're going to feel it. Yeah, I disagree with Neva to the extent that more money doesn't solve things. I think that if we just throw money mindlessly at things, you know, sure, that wouldn't solve our problem. But we have a prison crisis that our state has created of its own making. 116% prison capacity. We have 1,500 inmates over capacity, 3,000 more inmates, and 25% fewer DOC staff over the course of the last 4 or 5 years. You know, we're in a real crisis with corrections, and to say that we can just, you know, find cuts there, really, there's no cuts to be had. The only pitch that we'll get there is, oh, we can privatize that, but the private folks that are really not, you know, corporations, they're, you know, corporations in name only, they're more like cartels. In any other world, they would be convicted of human trafficking and put in the very prisons that they're operating, but, you know, that's not the case right now. But they'll undercut the state's rates for, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years, sustain the losses, and they'll come back and they'll hit us with a bigger bill, because we can't do this stuff for free. There are certain obligations that we just can't walk away from, and they cost money. And so, you know, politicians get reelected with the idea of cutting taxes. But I don't think that the voters, that the electorate, have really been given a clear picture for many years about what the trade-offs are for those tax cuts. You know, we can't just cut the taxes and then, you know, say that there are no cuts in services, because that's just not the way it works.
Before we go too far away from that question, because oil and gas is very important to this state, we do know that it might or might not have an impact on the budget. What about once we start doing layoffs, once we start increasing the unemployment in the state? What kind of effect will that have on the state?
Oh, I think it'll be, there's no question there will be an effect. When you look at 1 in 3 jobs in Oklahoma already are in some fashion tied to the energy sector, I mean, it is a significant problem. So I think we have to look at the short-term situation as well as, you know, the long term. And I think when we look at making adjustments in the budget, what we're talking about is not, you know, not taking from education or corrections or areas where we know those are services that legitimately need to be provided by the state. What we need to look at are a lot of other places where there are tens of millions of dollars being spent that have over time been somebody's pet project, been somebody's pet program that has been perpetuated, that now, whether it's a handful of people in a small agency or whether it's something, you know, just mired into a larger agency, there are places legitimately where those dollars can be looked at. And I think that's where it gets tough and lawmakers want to kind of gloss over it and not worry and want to take an across-the-board cut rather than being strategic and precise and trying to really deal with the real problems and get some real results out of it.
Well, right. We also don't get... So we haven't seen the political courage to make those cuts. That's where, you know, if lawmakers were honest and they wanted to sit down and say, listen, we think it's more important that the top-earning Oklahomans get a tax cut and walk away with more money in their pocket at the end of the year than it is to maintain class sizes or to maintain education programs or to ensure that our corrections officers aren't guarding, you know, hundreds of inmates to a ratio of one officer. You know, if we would have those conversations, I think that would be one thing, but we don't. In the last year, instead of having those tough conversations, we used one-time funding to the tune of nearly $400 million to plug huge budget holes rather than having those tough conversations. You know, this year, we're seeing the governor talking about $1 billion sitting on the table in revolving funds and cash reserves and having that same, you know, Play-Doh mentality of let's just patch it up and hope that it works. And it's not just a matter of the economy. Whenever oil prices tank and the economy sees layoffs and more folks out of work, what that also means is an increased demand for the very state services that we're cutting. So we're seeing the economy come down, and we've lived under this fiction. We've been sold this fiction for the longest time that Oklahoma is recession-proof, and we're just not. Nowhere is recession-proof. That's just not the way the economy works. And so the economy comes down, increased demand for services, but we've underfunded those services for so long that they're not going to be there. Training, healthcare, mental health, they're just not going to be there for the folks that
need
them.
One of the things, too, when you talk about on the oil and gas and the impact, when you look at schools, I mean, we forget how totally interconnected and intertwined all of these budgets and all of the ramifications are. You have $600 million directly going back into these local school districts from the production revenue. And when you look at that, in many of these districts, that's more than a third of their particular budget. That if you suck out a third of their budget that they're not going to have, I mean, the impact at the local level is extreme on education as well as all of the other areas in the economy that we're talking about. So you can't be one-dimensional in facing the real big problems, and you also can't be one-dimensional in the solutions. So I think that is the challenge for lawmakers, is to put up or shut up. And it doesn't matter what party, it's about dealing with the dollars and being realistic and getting some real results.
And we got a question back here.
Wondering if you all had heard scuttlebutt about possible reductions or eliminations of tax credits, including possibly the solar credit, to pay for teacher raises?
I think there has been discussion and there have been some accounts in news reports that is an area that is being looked at. I don't know that I've seen any specifics, and maybe Ryan has, but it is an area that apparently, just because of the press and the pressure of having to come up with where these sources are that can be moved around or looked at for more dollars, I think that is one area that even the speaker indicated in his first message in the legislature that he felt like this was a place that, even though it was very difficult, just like the off the top money that comes out of the budget, leaving only 44% to be appropriated after everything that's already set is done, they don't have that many, you know, when they look at it, they've got 44% of the money there left to appropriate. They're going to have to get better at doing it and not just kind of do the you know, shifted around on the table, and at the end of the session, just walk away knowing that it's going to come back and confront them. And I think we see that on many of the big issues. The Indian Cultural Museum is a perfect example. When you start talking dollars and you start talking, you know, somebody having to make a decision, the question is, you know, I mean, it would be easy, and some lawmakers are saying, well, let's just send it to a vote of the people. If we have to send big, tough decisions to a vote of the people, then we don't need a legislature making these decisions. And again, that's not a partisan, you know, comment. That's just a straight up smart business comment. I mean, they need to take care of business, put the vote out there, and take a up or down vote and be done with it and move on. Quit dragging it along session after session, hoping that something's going to change and money's going to drop in, you know, from somewhere that they didn't expect, and they're going to use it for that particular project.
Ryan, tax credits have been pushed by Democrats mm-hmm. since you were in the legislature.
Yeah.
Are they finally coming around to the idea of maybe getting rid of some of these tax credits?
Well, we've been talking about eliminating certain tax credits for almost as long as I can remember now. And there have been some real heroes out of the state legislature that have been, you know, hauling these things out on the floor and saying, you know, are these worthwhile? Are they worth the millions of dollars that they cost the state of Oklahoma in revenue every year? But you know, we've not really seen, again, the political courage to move forward on it. You know, during this last legislative session, one of those, the biggest of those tax credits, the horizontal drilling credit that costs the state of Oklahoma nearly $250 million a year to incentivize something that's going to occur anyways. You know, that finally, whenever it got really, when the rubber hit the road on that thing, and the lobbyists for the oil and gas industry showed up at the Capitol, we saw legislative courage, you know, go out the window. You know, these legislators buckled, and they voted for the oil and gas lobby for the drilling credit to extend it. The more lucrative the credit, the more likely you're going to see the lobbyist out there to defeat it. And so, you know, some of these low-hanging fruit that don't have organized lobbying efforts, you know, we might see them picked off. Are they going to add up to enough money to pay for the $150 million that it's going to take this year for Superintendent Hoffmeister's five-year plan to raise teacher salary up to the regional average, which is a great plan, but $150 million is going to require some very tough decisions. You know, you mentioned, you know, the off-the-top fund for the Road and Bridge Trust, you know, that expires next year. You know, so, you know, the legislature is going to have that money there. But then we're in this position, this really awful position of saying, well, you know, we can finally fund our teachers and our schools and education the way we want to, but now we're going to have to rob that money from the trust and take it out of roads and bridges, you know, so that, you know, the kids, you're going to have to drive over decrepit bridges on their way to the schoolhouses that we're able to marginally increase the funding to.
Hey, any other questions? What do we got? Right back here.
Well, at my table, we've already had a unanimous vote that I'm naive about this. But I wanted to follow up on the vote of the people part. And when we look around this grassroots rebellion going on against testing in Oklahoma, liberal, conservative, doesn't matter, generation, it doesn't matter. It's almost universal in hatred of the test and punish regime we've had. Yeah. Why can't we build on that? One of the things we could do is we could, since these standardized tests aren't just angering adults, but they're seriously damaging kids. They're especially when it comes to poor children of color, it's completely robbing them of a education. Why can't we unite on that policy issue and seriously cut back on the standardized test and remove all stakes from test to the individual, any linkage between test results and the individual?
I think that we're going to see some real movement on that this legislative session. You know, there have been several bills filed. I haven't looked at the details of them, but there have been several bills filed that would attack the high-stakes standardized testing. Oklahoma has 9 more high-stakes testing than the national mandates require. And I think that there's at least one bill that would move us down to the national minimum of standardized testing for high stakes. But, you know, I think that you're right. There has been this coalition from the right and the left, grassroots, across the board, administrators, teachers, parents, folks that realize that this isn't the best way to measure progress in our schools, is to take one student on one day of his or her life and say the school's either is either passing or failing on the basis of that child's day. Superintendent New, Rob New, the new superintendent here in Oklahoma City, and I'm paraphrasing here, he says it a lot better than I do, but you know, we've made tests important and we evaluate teachers on the basis of those tests, but instead we need to decide what's important and evaluate our school system on that and let that drive the conversation. You know, for too long we haven't really had a conversation about what's important, what should we be measuring and evaluating ourselves on. I don't think that there's anyone out there that thinks that our school system should be totally without accountability, that there shouldn't be some way to measure and evaluate whether our schools are doing what we as a society hope them to do. But to put all of the emphasis on these high-stakes tests is failing our schools, failing our students, and failing teachers and educators just across the board. But I think we're going to see some movement on that this session.
Neva, do you also think we'll see movement on doing something about standardized testing?
I think we will, but I think the issue, you have to take into account a number of things, and I think this is something that lawmakers are getting kind of hit square in the face with. When you look at the recent reports that show that Oklahoma has the fourth highest student poverty rate in the nation, I mean, that clearly ties to the whole education problem. That's something that sometimes we like to extract out and sometimes compartmentalize, but Oklahoma City Public Schools, 90% of the students qualify for free and reduced lunch. That number is high in many districts all across this state. So we've got big problems. But when we talk about whether the whole issue of testing and performance, what we've got to do is figure out a way that we can educate kids so that they can read and write, so that when they get out of high school, 40% of them are not in remedial coursework to be able to go to college. I mean, we've got to educate them so that they can become productive members of the workforce, or we have defeated our whole purpose. So, I mean, how the education establishment and community deal with the internal workings of that. The bottom line is most of us in this room went through public schools, got an education, and were able to go on and do what we set out to do in life. And we have a vast majority of Oklahoma kids right now that aren't being afforded that opportunity. Some by virtue of poverty and their own circumstances, but those things are things that have to be factored into the overall equation by the lawmakers.
I think, you know, the real question on testing is what takes their place. You know, if we see the legislature come in and say we're going to remove high stakes testing, you know, there's still this political demand for accountability. What takes their place? And that's going to be an incredibly important conversation for the legislature to have. And it's not one that they should use as an opportunity to stand on their high horses and talk about how they know what's best for education. They really need to bring the experts into the room.
Well, and we've already heard that upcoming rally on March 30th or whatever the date is that's been set, they're expecting, you know, they would like to say 50,000 parents and others coming to the Capitol. If we see that kind of energy and that kind of movement from Oklahomans who want to really demand and command attention at the Capitol from these lawmakers, then it'll be back to the days of Henry Bellman and 1017. There will be some action, whether they want to make those votes or not. The pressure will be serious enough that they will see something happen, whether they like it or not.
Right.
Yeah, all this talk about testing takes away the issue of school funding, and I'd like to see them close down some prisons instead of the schools. We lock up too many people that aren't doing any harm. We're going to pay for an education. Let's do that.
I didn't hear the last part of your question.
Yes, repeat that last part.
If we're going to pay for an education, let's go ahead and do that. But shut down the prisons. We don't need to lock up all these nonviolent people.
Well, you know, so I think it was, you know, the question of, you know, why are we talking about you know, maybe we should redirect corrections funding to education. I agree. You know, the problem is we're 116% capacity. And the leadership that we've seen on criminal justice reform hasn't been a lot of leadership. I mean, there's been a lot of platitudes. Here's, you know, for somebody who works on criminal justice reform, it's very frustrating because you hear people on the right and the left saying all of the right things. Everybody seems to realize that we've got a criminal justice system that's broken. You know, whether or not everybody acknowledges the historical root for that broken criminal justice system or not, you know, there's still this idea that we've broken something and we need to fix it. But the problem is that there's not, again, been a lot of political courage to do that. The Justice Reinvestment Initiative, which, of course, was passed way back whenever Chris Steele was Speaker of the House. I think, was that 2012, whenever that passed. And a lot of it's remained unfunded or underfunded. We've turned down federal money to implement it. Now there's this renewed push from the governor's office to implement JRI. The problem is that none of these criminal justice reforms really address the underlying issue of why are we incarcerating a lot of these folks to begin with? You know, why should a lot of these folks even be in prisons to start with? Why are some actions criminal? And I think that until we, if we just look at JRI and some of these other initiatives, they don't roll back prison growth. All they do is slow it down. So our prisons that are at 116% capacity right now, and you know, some folks have said are really one lawsuit away from federal takeover. We don't move away from that. Instead of increasing at a certain rate, we increase maybe at a slower rate. And that, to me, is the underlying problem. If we shut down prisons right now, those inmates don't go away. We just shift them over to GEO or CCA or one of the private prison operators in the state of Oklahoma and enrich a bunch of campaign pals of the folks that are in power.
Neva, the governor did actually say prison overcrowding was one of the three things she wanted to take care of. Do you really think we'll see some steps this year to make some changes?
Probably of the three, I think that might be the one we might see the most significant real effort made and some real results, because there's all with many complicated pieces of policy legislation, I think what we find is it takes years. I mean, you don't just put something on the table, you don't just put a bill out there, and it doesn't just, you know, move on through the process in 100 days. I mean, it takes years, and it takes a lot of education, starting with education of lawmakers. And as we all know, I mean, with this continual turnover and a lot of new freshman faces at the Capitol next week, they're trying to figure out, you know, which way to their office, let alone, you know, how to read a bill and what all of the ramifications are. So it there really is a learning curve there that is, you know, I think has over the last decade really complicated the legislative process in Oklahoma, because we've seen so much rapid turnover. A lot of the folks that emerged and wound up in key leadership positions about the time they got there, got settled in and got their own agenda kind of moving, they were off to something else or out of office. So that's one of the byproducts that I think continues to compound this situation.
And right over here.
Well, just real quick on that. I think that, you know, I mentioned earlier that Governor Fallon had this opportunity for her Henry Bellman moment. And education, of course, is an important issue, but I really think that her Henry Bellman moment could be criminal justice reform if she would only seize it. And that's where I think the Republican caucuses in the Senate and the House that have these huge majorities and can essentially do whatever they want in the legislature, if there was some leadership by the governor's office to push for very significant and substantial reforms and to change the real conversation and the tone about the way politicians talk about criminal justice in Oklahoma, that could be the game changer that we're waiting for. And instead, you know, she's impaneled, she's got this new task force that's going to look into criminal justice issues. The recommendations for that won't be due until 2017. I don't think that there's been a real appreciation for the urgency of the situation. And, you know, sir, I'm with you. I think that, you know, why are we locking these folks up to begin with? The real conversation is, why are we locking up people for marijuana possession and distribution? Why are we confusing use with abuse? Why are we super penalizing people for low-grade property crimes? And the legislature hasn't got the message. There are more and more crimes added to the books every year so that we over-criminalize our society and make it almost impossible for some people to, one, stay out of prison, but two, when they get out, pay all their debts back, because we financed our criminal justice system on the backs of the people that we're incarcerating.